Owen Robertson, except for one chapter on Jews in his magnum opus. I read that for my book, Separation Discontents, talking about anti-Semitism. But I just hadn't gotten around to it. On the other hand, I talked to a number of people for whom it had been a transformative experience, and it converted them, and it just changed their life. And so it really was a sort of eye-opener for me to actually get to read the book. What's really amazing about it is that Robertson saw so clearly the outlines of the decline of white America. Certainly, his first edition was around 1970. I find his prescience amazing because during the 1970s, I was a young adult, still caught up in the attitudes of the countercultural left that had become dominant in the 1960s. The Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 had only recently been enacted. It had not resulted in a sea change in the demographic base of the country. However, Robertson was quite aware that this revolution was well underway, that in effect, white America was a conquered people. At that time, a solid majority of white Americans, including myself, believed that the U.S. had solved its racial problems. With the passage of the Civil Rights legislation, we felt confident of the future and even sort of morally uplifted because the sins of America's past had been eradicated. If we'd been asked what the future of America would look like, we would have assumed that America would stay white, but that it would be free of racial tensions, poverty would have been eradicated, attitudes that seemed extremely, obviously very, very wrong in retrospect, as we contemplate in America, where indeed we have racial tensions, where they continue to escalate, and 47 million people are on food stamps. Robertson understood that by 1970, there had been a fundamental change in the people that essentially run America. And he understood that this change had already displaced the formerly dominant European majority in key areas of power of American society. To be sure, as Robertson points out, Madison Grant and Lathrop Stoddard foresaw the decline of the white race, and to use Stoddard's phrase, the rising tide of color. But Robertson was the first to really spell out the decline of white America, the first to show that the dispossession had happened already, even though the vast majority of whites then, and even now, had no idea that they were a conquered people. In 1970, Americans of European descent were still a dominant demographic majority, but they had ceded their place at the top of the society. And as a result, they certainly did not control their long-term future. He understood that the main force behind the dispossession of white America, and he understood that this new group at the top of our society was, quote, implacably hostile. He used to actually use that word, implacably hostile. I've often talked about hostile elites, and then reading Robertson, you see it. He had that idea, implacably hostile to the traditional American majority, with grim forebodings for the future. Unlike so many writers, Robertson always mentions that the ethnic backgrounds of the people that he's writing about. So early on, he talks about Franz Boas in creating the first comprehensively developed, this is a quote, the first comprehensively developed theory of racial equality. And he notes that Boas's follower, Ashley Montague, quote, a physical anthropologist of Anglo-Jewish origin, became the first great vulgarizer of racial egalitarianism with a seemingly endless stream of best-selling books, television appearances and speeches before learned and unlearned society. This theory was quite compatible with behaviorism. It talks about that, which was not a Jewish movement. But it also stressed the importance of the environment in shaping human behavior. With the dominance of this environmentalist zeitgeist, quote, by the early 1960s, the idea that racial equality, that there could possibly be race differences of things like IQ and so on, was so firmly established in the modern education and communications media, it was difficult to question it and still maintain one's academic or professional respectability. So this ideology of racial inequality, fed into the sea change inaugurated by the 1965 immigration law, one result of which was that the white majority was no longer protected legislatively from massive displacement-level immigration. As a result, there was a huge upsurge in non-white immigration, and that continues to accelerate today. Of course, today we have the bill that was passed by the U.S. Senate, which would admit, somewhere above, around 12 to 20 million aliens from Latin America, and also increase immigration, which is legal, from 1 to 1.5 million per year. This is just in displacement on steroids. Robertson concludes, quote, whatever happens on the immigration front, the American population will continue to be put through a racial grinder. Not imperceptibly, the complexion is growing darker every decade. And again, he's doing this in the 1970s, before anybody else is really aware of that. In his argument that the majority is in fact dispossessed, Robertson emphasizes that whites do not have any organizations that explicitly advance their interests. Indeed, even now, as whites slip into minority status, organizations that explicitly favor white interests are vanishingly rare, marginalized, and ineffectual. They're routinely attacked by well-funded Jewish activist organizations, particularly the Anti-Defamation League, the Southern Poverty Law Center, as, quote, white supremacists. White supremacists being a term of the left, a term of art routinely employed by the media for any white who dares to think that whites have interests and whites will suffer huge costs by becoming a minority. Whites are politically divided between two parties, neither of which seeks to advance their interests. They are powerless to shape public opinion because messages supporting white identity and white interests are excluded by the mainstream media. As one illustration of majority powerlessness, Robertson points to the Apollo moon landing, which resulted in an outburst of pride for typical white Americans. It was attacked by Jewish writer Norman Mailer in a mass circulation magazine as, in Robertson's summary, a, quote, wacky, unjustifiable, wasteful, semi-Nazi adventure insulting to the aspiration of Negroes. Unbelievable. He notes that while the majority was being devalued, books on the superiority of Jews as a master race were coming out at that time, were being advertised in all the elite media and endorsed by so-called racial egalitarian Ashley Montague. Robertson lists the characteristics of Northern Europeans that have led to their huge power at the beginning of the 20th century, as described originally by Tacitus. A fondness for personal freedom, the independence of spirit, the very high status accorded to women, and a deep affection for the land. He comments that such attitudes and habits were probably the seeds of the Magna Carta and the subsequent British emphasis on individual rights and liberties. Perhaps the greatest institutional achievement at all was the legal system. At its base was the European emphasis that society must be based on the free individual. Despite being the majority, these Europeans were dispossessed because they were politically divided. They lost because rather than fight against their dispossession as a cohesive, unified group, the vast majority, especially the best and brightest, accommodated to this new regime. Quote, they sleepwalk through life, oblivious or ignoring the racial reality, terrified of being called a, quote, racist or a white supremacist. He calls them pussyfooters. They rise to power as leaders of supposedly downtrodden minorities, the Grockites. They go along with the new regime in order to protect their career and other forms of self-interest, the trucklers. They seek to restore the past by advocating various solutions that seem to work in the past. Christianity, the Constitution, libertarianism, anything to avoid talking about the reality of racial dispossession. Calls those old believers. Or they are explicit race traitors who are actively preoccupied with destroying their own people. Robertson's chapter on Jews is the centerpiece of the book. It describes Jews as being, quote, at the apex of the American pyramid. You'd already had a changing of the elites in America when he wrote that, with a central role in the displacement of the formerly dominant Northern European elites. Just as no one can fully understand present-day world affairs without taking Jews into account, and so there's no member of the American majority can even begin to comprehend the pattern of current American events without a rudimentary knowledge of the aims, the habits, and the political, economic, and social status of American Jews. It's as true now as when he said it back in the 70s. I agree that by the 1920s, it could be fairly said that Jews were setting the tone for much of Western culture. Marx, Freud, Einstein, Bergson, Wittgenstein, Boas. He charts the rise of Jews to elite status in all walks of American life, business and personal wealth, politics, academia, and the media. He correctly notes that Jewish intellectuals like Einstein and Freud are endlessly praised as icons, where these the accomplishments of non-Jews are ignored or given lesser value. And he points his finger at the critical issue. Unlike any other group, and certainly the Europeans that they replaced, Jewish power is off limits for rational discussion. Quote, instead of submitting anti-Semitism to the free play of ideas, instead of making it a topic for debate in which all can join, Jews and their supporters have managed to organize an inquisition in which all acts, writings, and even thoughts critical of Jewry are treated as a threat to the moral order of mankind. Very true today. This is indeed the crux of the matter. This lack of discussion of Jewish power means that the great majority of white Americans are not aware of the extent of Jewish power, and it means that those who are aware are forced to remain silent unless they are willing to risk their reputations and careers. He also reviews briefly the theories of Jewish behavior, which I found interesting. He talks about Darwinian selection for wealth and urban cosmopolitan, the theory of Weil, the B-E-Y-L, his theory that wealthy, intelligent Jews had more children, John Murray Cudahy's theory of Jewish loathing of Western civility, with the aim of, quote, to divide and destroy Western political and economic order. Robertson doubts that Jews are more intelligent and notes that Jewish involvement in disastrous political adventures, including particularly the Jewish involvement in early decades of the Soviet Union and the abortive communist revolutions of the 1920s in Germany and Hungary. He presents the view that Jews have been successful mainly because they are better organized and have a stronger sense of race consciousness, which feeds into ethnic networking, which I think is what he's trying to say. Here he footnotes data showing that Jews are overwhelmingly more likely to favor other Jews as doctors and lawyers, ethnic networking. My view is that all of these are important. It wouldn't matter that Jews are this elite if they did not loathe the American white majority, as Cudahy notes, that indeed Jews are a hostile elite. It is this loathing, also accompanied by fear, that whites could rise up against Jews stemming from Jewish consciousness of historical anti-Semitism that has motivated them to pursue policies that are opposed to the interests of the white majority. Most importantly, displacement-level non-white immigration. On the other hand, Jewish racial loyalty is what's behind the various distortions of the U.S. foreign policy. It resulted in costly wars and a huge financial drain on behalf of Israel. Jewish ethnic networking and intelligence feed into Jewish wealth. He's well aware of the importance of Jewish wealth, providing his readers with a long list of wealthy Jews, noting their involvement in virtually all areas of the American economy, emphasizing the importance of wealth in underlying Jewish power. Examples abound, but particularly noteworthy are Jewish role in funding both the Democratic and Republican Party and the Israel Lobby, also the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League, I'd point out. His forays into aesthetics and U.S. foreign policy are fundamentally informed by the need to consider the racial ethnic angle and the cost of multiculturalism to the American majority. Again, he's way ahead of this, talking the cost of multiculturalism, say, for art. When it comes to art, his views actually remind me of Richard Wagner. The artist, quote, must belong to the dominant population. An artist needs an audience which understands him, an audience of his own people. Minority artists are alienated from the rhythms and deeper feelings of the majority. They are a, quote, heterogeneous, fragmented society resulting from multiculturalism results in a contending, conflicting mass of cultures and subcultures. Minority artists essentially develop a culture of critique, sinking into hostility towards the majority, tapping their own ethnic roots, which results in outpourings of ethnic pride for their own group and hostility towards the white majority. In a homogeneous society, the artist need not always try to be fair. Quote, he need not be morally afraid of wounding the religious or racial feelings of others. What really limit and devitalize art are not the artist's prejudices, but his audience's prejudices, of which there is in a vast heterogeneous society like the United States, there is an almost infinite variety. In such a world, the arbiter of taste is no longer the art lover, but the art dealer, and I would say the art critic. Art is transformed into artiness. In such a society, it is inconceivable that a white artist could write novels or paint paintings in which whites are heroes. If he did, he, quote, would be laughed out of modern literature. Unless white artists become trucklers or flaunt their own minority status, such as homosexuals, they are excluded from the art world. On the other hand, art that plays into white guilt, or even in the case of some black artists, this is certainly going on in the 1970s, portrays the rape or violation of white women, slitting white throats, is published and praised. A recent egregious example is Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained, in which blacks are portrayed performing bloody reprisals against white slave owners. Tarantino identifies as a non-white due to his being part of the American Indian. The film was produced by Stacey Scher, who is Jewish, and Reginald Hudlin, who is black. Robinson argues that Jewish domination in the media has a huge effect on what passes as art. Quote, the press, the magazines, and TV are the transmission belts of the art, and as such, its supreme arbiter. A book not reviewed favorably or not reviewed at all, if you can't do that, they can't get into libraries, they can't have any. In fact, recently Paul Gottfried is very upset. He published a book by Cambridge University Press, and it was not reviewed because it was critical of neocons. It was critical of Leo Strauss. Simply ignored it. He was furious, and I've never seen anybody so furious in putting his cards on the table, as he said, putting my cards on the table. This is a good book. Why isn't it being discussed? It's not going to be discussed because it's critical of the power structure. A few other things here. Concludes with a chapter called The Ingathering of Northern Europeans. This chapter is chilling and hopeful. Northern Europeans can reclaim their racial identity. He hopes that a resurgence would require rejecting all of the main currents of modern liberal thought. And he italicized the word all for emphasis. A resurgence can only come about if there is an understanding of how and why these ideologies have, quote, been developed and synthesized in the most unbending intellectual absolutism since medieval scholasticism. He writes that majority members must reject principles near and dear to their hearts, such as the rights of man, the dignity of the individual. In the perverted modern form, they were killers of society. Democracy, genuine liberalism, the common law, the free play of the imagination, the technological breakthroughs, all the great political, social, and scientific achievements of Western man were now the spoils of non-Western man. But he is hopeful. Quote, just as the body rejects transplanted organs, races have the habit of rejecting transplanted ideologies. They may accept them temporarily, but the buildup of antibodies is unceasing. The only ideology acceptable to all races would seem to be in the grand design of evolution, which will ultimately select one of them to give birth to a new species, the better than man. We too must continue to hope that there will be a resurgence of white America. As he suggests in several passages, as present trends continue, they will necessarily produce an awareness among white Americans that they are being displaced, and they will clearly see the costs of being displaced. Under these conditions, psychological mechanisms underlying in-group cohesiveness are indeed likely to be triggered. Whites will likely develop more cohesiveness and begin the struggle for survival. Robertson was well aware that this new Jewish elite had taken strong steps to prevent any discussion of its power and influence. However, it's worth remembering that in the latter stages of the Soviet Union, people did not believe what the media were telling them because there was an obvious gap between these media accounts and the realities that they could see all around them. And with the spread of the internet, the information on the forces resulting in the decline of white America is widely available. Counter-currents and things like that. It's not over until it's over. Thank you. That's a good question. That's what the culture critique is all about, the book I wrote. You know, it's really about, I think, networking, ultimately. It's about, having had a lot of students. He's at Columbia, and the students then went around to all the big universities, like Berkeley and so on, and headed those departments, and they recruit students that are on board, and if you're not on board, you're expelled. Yeah, all those movements, they understood that what's really important in the academic world is consensus. Truth is not important. And that's what I think Paul Gottfried, he keeps thinking truth is important, you know, and he's wondering why his book isn't being reviewed. It's such a good book. Well, it may be a really good book, but if it doesn't meet their political, intellectual interests, it's not going to be reviewed, or it's going to be reviewed very negatively. But that's how it works in the academic world. It worked for a century now, basically, where you bring your people in, you have these gurus like Boas who can, at a big university, and they can put their students around, especially for him, because the field of anthropology hardly existed. You know, so he was like a virgin territory. He could just send somebody out to Berkeley, and they're the first anthropologist there, and they recruit students. So it had a huge effect on the whole profession. And you've got his followers like Montague, like Wilmot Roberts was talking about. You know, and that's just the way it works.
Was he affiliated with a political party or a...
He was far left.
Far left.
Yeah, socialist.
But he had a communist background.
Yeah.
Socialist, German. Yeah.
At least a communist sympathetic. You know, it's also come out that Boas actually falsified some data.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure about that.
Stephen Jay Gould did a lot
of that, too. His skull measuring thing, yeah.
Yeah.
They're only cooking they're good at is cook the books.
Yeah. Yeah. All kinds of books.
Right.
Any other questions, thoughts, comments? That's a great thing. I met Wilmot Robertson near the end of his life in 2000. And he signed my copy of The Dispossessed Majority, which made me very happy. And he was asked what he thought we needed, as a framework for moving our cause forward in the present time. And he said some kind of Freemasonry, some kind of secret society. So that was his suggestion.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions or thoughts? Because if not, let's give these gentlemen a hand.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.